Thank you all so much for being here. And I was just talking to Nicole, and she said, I hate the timeliness of today's forum. I could not have said it better. It's just bad that we have to do this, but it is something that we have to do. And thank you all for being a part of this conversation, this so important conversation. And I heard Amanda and Dan say, we're already planning a part two. So that's important. We're starting a plan. Well, it's bad, but it's good that we already know that we have to have a part two of this conversation. So today's topic is Chicago at the Crossroads, the future of community policing. Did I see Jesse Ruiz walk in the door? I thought I did. Hey, Jeff. I'm not going to read Laura's bio because is there anybody in this room by a show of hands who does not know her awesomeness? That's what I thought. And if you don't, go to the webpage. You can take a look at it. I'm going to invite this award-winning journalist, Chicago Tribune and ABC 7, to the mic. She's going to introduce the rest of our panelists. I see questions coming up. People, if you see our folks moving, it's because they're bringing Laura questions still. This is kind of be happening in real time today. And I see people still getting their card in the fishbowl. So it's important. I'm telling you, it's good. So what they're doing down there. I am going to come down from here so that I don't make us any more late. Laura's going to bring up the rest of the panelists. Everybody keep your eyes and ears open. I think we're in for a treat today. Thank you, Laura.
Well, first of all, please thank you very much for not reading that bio. You know how we all have bios and we put everything but the kitchen sink in them, right? But that's not so you're supposed to read them. So thank you for not doing that. And you know, I have to differ with you on the bad. Of course, what happened in Memphis is horrific. But if we need a wake up call, and it seems like we need a wake up call on a pretty regular basis, let it be. And so I think it's really important that we're having this conversation now. It was an important conversation before that terrible thing happened. But remember, that terrible thing has happened many, many times across this country and particularly in this city. So it's time for us to get past the things that have not worked and really begin to focus on the things that work. And that's hopefully what we're going to do today. And I'm honored to be able to share in this conversation. So first, I would like to ask all of our panels to come to join me up here on the podium, and then I will provide brief introductions for this incredibly illustrious group of people. Their full bios are on the website, and you are familiar with many of them in their work throughout the city. So I want to keep the intros brief so we can have time for the important part of the conversation. So as they come to the stage. No, it doesn't matter. I will start on my immediate right with Nicole Jordan McBride, who is the Advocacy Director for the Chicago Neighborhood Policing Initiative. The initiative is a policing philosophy grounded in the principle that public safety is the responsibility of everyone who works and lives in the neighborhood, and that we are safer when we communicate effectively and work together. Oh, your mom's here? Well, then we know it's an important conversation. Where's mom? Where's mom? Thank you, Rosanna. And Rosanna Ander, right next to Nicole, is the founding executive director of the University of Chicago Crime Lab and the University of Chicago Education Lab, which works to design, test, and scale data-driven programs and practices to improve the public sector's approach to public safety and education. Welcome, Rosanna. Andrew Papakristos is currently a professor of sociology and a faculty fellow at the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern University. He is also the founder and faculty director of Corners, the Center for Neighborhood Engaged Research and Science. You don't want to cut off his bio. And finally, Mike Milstein is the deputy director at the Chicago Police Department, who oversees the Office of Community Policing, where he manages all positive non-enforcement engagements between police and communities. He also leads the Chicago Police Department's Civil Rights Unit, which includes its hate crime team and community liaison team. Mike Milstein. So, as I said, this is a very important moment, especially for the city of Chicago. After what you heard about in Memphis and so many other incidents of violence in the community, some people may be beginning to wonder if there are any real solutions or there are any real answers. But this, the group that you're going to hear from today is going to tell you that there are, and they are all around enhancing, bolstering, celebrating, promoting community policing. So I wanted to start by just by asking each one of you, and let's start with you, Nicole. Why is it important that we are having this conversation now? Beyond all the things that we have said, what is the most important thing about why we're having it now? And what are the necessary ingredients of effective community policing?
Thank you so much. I think that in order to really have this conversation, we have to ground it in some kind of historical context. In Chicago, we first saw some kind of structured community policing program put in place within CPD back in 1993 with CAPS. Since CAPS, in just, 30 years now, we have seen the funding shift, right, from what it once was to being very essentially devalued externally, but more importantly, internally, right? When we shift funding from community policing, then we say that that is not a strategic priority for the police department. And if it's not a strategic priority, then it also means that every officer that's coming into the community isn't first and foremost thinking, every single action that I take will either push us towards good relationships with the community or push us away from good community police relationships. So if you go forward to 2018, we see this is post Laquan McDonald. This is the CPD is now facing or undergoing a consent decree to really address some pattern and practices that most people in communities of color already knew and had been for a long time saying was happening, but now at a very national level was being recognized in Chicago. So we have this connection of the shift of community police relationships, poor relationship building, and lack of trust within communities of color who arguably need it the most. And now we have a consent decree. And we also have community members that are fighting diligently for a community oversight board to make sure that community voice is centered in community and police policy, and that community voice is centered in how police show up in our community, but this time differently, this time with an ordinance to make sure that funding does not shift away from community input, but is firmly put in place. Then finally, we also have the introduction of a pilot of the Chicago Neighborhood Policing Initiative, which in many respects attempts to push the Chicago Police Department back to the original idea of community policing. And that is that community policing is not just the responsibility of a subset of officers, but it is the responsibility of every single beat officer that is working in the community to build relationships, to understand the needs of the community, and most importantly, to talk to community members to understand from their perspective what the challenges are and what the answers to those challenges are. And to me, that is at the heart of community policing and is at the heart of all policing strategy.
Thank you, and I think if it's okay, I'll just go down the line. And of course, Rosanna, if you would like to respond to anything she said, but back to the basic question: why is this important now, and what are the necessary ingredients to make it effective?
I mean, I think it's blindingly obvious why it's important now. I mean, Chicago is a city facing enormous challenges, both on safety in communities, but also the legitimacy of the government that is supposed to be trusted to help produce that with the community. And Chicago's not alone in facing that crisis. And I just don't think that we can get to the place that all of us want to be, whatever part of the city you're in, if we don't have faith in our government to work with us, to be transparent with us, to be held accountable for what they're doing. And I just think we are in such a place of crisis in our country right now in terms of the legitimacy of the role of police in our society. And I don't think that we're going to fix it by going back to 1980-style policing, which is crushing crime at the same time that you're alienating the very community that's suffering the crime and now suffering the mass incarceration. And so mm-hmm. I just don't think that we can do the kinds of policing or public safety in our country and in our city without having communities being fully at the table, helping to define what it is that they want from their government and in particular policing, and being a partner in that work. And so I just think that, you just look at what we're experiencing right now as a city and as a country, and it feels blindingly obvious that we need to get to a place where there is a whole different sort of relationship and power dynamic between our government and the citizens, the residents who most need a government to work for them.
And how do you answer the question is, what's the main ingredient to make it effective? Is what you just said, is changing the power dynamic or?
I think there are a bunch of ingredients that are important, and it starts with being transparent, mm-hmm. being willing to answer questions honestly, being willing to share information, being willing to come to the residents in the communities that are being served and asking them what they want from their government. What is it that they need help with? What is it that they're most concerned about? And work, being transparent about what you're going to do in response, and then being transparent about what's working and what's not working, and also recognizing. And look, I want to recognize that we're not only failing the communities that are suffering the dual harms of gun violence and mass incarceration. We're also failing the officers that are being fed into a broken system. Mm-hmm. Like, they are not happy. And so it starts with, really kind of redefining what that role of police is, and how it relates to other parts of the ecosystem, as well as, making sure that there are true and authentic mechanisms to get community voice. And again, people talk about community as though it's monolithic. There are lots of perspectives, and we have to have ways to hear the variety of perspectives. And then we need our government to do its level best to be responsive to what residents are asking for.
Okay. And there are a lot of different definitions, or a lot of people have a lot of different definitions and perceptions of what community policing is. And Mike Milstein, I think I introduced you out of order. My apologies, but you're running the community policing program at the police department now. How would you define it, and how would you respond to the issue of what are the crucial ingredients?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me and inviting the department to be here today. We always try to define community policing first and foremost as a philosophy, that is actually both defined for us in the consent decree and required that we incorporate into all of our community policing strategies. But one that we've also tried to expand on and also incorporate into our own mission and vision within community policing. In our office in community policing, we have that vision that every police officer on the Chicago Police Department should and must be a community policing officer, meaning that they should be able to go out there, engage communities in a proactive and positive way to do problem solving, to do the work that MPI is doing, to do basic day-to-day procedural justice and positive engagement. So we try to incorporate that philosophy across the department into many different strategies. But to kind of go back to the other question about what is an ingredient that is needed, I think community policing is also a set of different programs and initiatives and efforts that help to support that philosophy. Things like NPI, things like CAPS, when it was first started in the 1990s. We have now a crime victim assistance program. We have a civil rights unit, all sorts of things that are designed to bolster up that idea that community policing has to be a positive way that we are engaging with communities, helping to address different challenges, different needs that the community is seeing, and giving the community a voice in policing strategy. So really having an effective community policing strategy that is designed to create those different opportunities to work with the community, to bring the community into our process, I think is really crucial.
Now, I don't want to put you on the spot because you represent the police department, and there's been just today there's been some critique of the police department and how it functions and our government and how it functions. What would you say are the what are your challenges? What could you be doing better? Or what would you like to be doing better if you had more resources, if you had more time, some more support? How would you like to improve?
Yeah, I think a big piece that we're always looking to improve on is community partnerships. Mm-hmm. I think we recognize that police cannot do this work alone. We cannot address the root causes of crime. We cannot address the root causes of challenges in our communities. And so we need to be able to work with different community partners, all of you all who are really doing the hard work in the communities to figure out how can we make a difference. You know, a big piece of community policing is also how do we address violence and how do we address violence in a public, in a community-oriented way? And a lot of that is, you know, really the need for us to be able to work collaboratively with the community, with our community partners, to try to make that difference there.
And what do you mean by how do you address violence?
By addressing the root causes. Mm-hmm. You know, again, you know, police officers are not social workers. We're not mm-hmm. school counselors. But there are many community organizations across the city who are doing that kind of work. That if we were able to partner with them to figure out how we can make an impact on some of those root issues that are creating the violence in the communities or that is leading to violence in communities, I think that's an area that we need to be a little bit more strategic and mindful of.
So that kind of relationship is partnership's not really happening right now.
In some places, yes. In some places, I think we're still trying to figure out what that looks like.
Well, I'm sure Nicole might have some suggestions for that.
I'm sure
we'll get back to her in a second. But I wanted to bring Professor Papakristos in to get your perspective, why this is important, and what are the key ingredients, particularly around. Based on some of the research that you've done on this issue.
So I actually would plus one basically everything that was said. I mean, we keep returning to this issue of community policing. And, you know, it started here in the 90s when NPI, just to, again, context, we talked about what's happening today, you know, with the funeral services that are going on. You know, NPI started after the video of Laquan McDonald's released, before Jason Van Dyke was sentenced, and Adam Toledo and George Floyd were still alive. But at each one of those moments, we came back to this issue about something between the relationship between the community and the police, right? And at those moments, the social contract is frayed, torn, destroyed. People feel it viscerally, as they should. But what we come back to is something, and Rosanna had said it, Nicole had said it, you know, is it trust? Is it cynicism? At the same time of not wanting to be afraid, right? And those two things actually exist at the same time, right? You can fear... you know, you can be fearful for your life in many situations, you know, mass incarceration, of course, the gun violence, people having a safety gap in their own communities. And then also thinking about what that means from feeling fearful of the state or cynical of the state. But yet time and time again, and it just doesn't come just from the police, which I think is one of the important lessons we're learning from our partners that are sitting right here and some that are over there, is that there's a desire to have a working relationship in the maintenance of public safety, including with the police, but extending to the broader violence prevention or civil infrastructure that people are developing. And it's changed. It's not, you know, it's not 1992. Mm-hmm. We have cell phones. We have cameras. We have a 311 service, which, by the way, didn't exist in 1992. So you used to go to the beat meetings to get that graffiti off. Well, you don't have to go to a beat meeting to get graffiti taken off, nor probably should you. And so all those developments are changed to think about where are we in 2023, and what does rebuilding or repairing or building for the first time faith in an institution? And again, we talk about the police, but it's the state. We're talking about the state. It is the armed presence of the state. And people, you know, have lots of opinions about it, which I think is the other thing. And how do you do that in a representative democracy?
Well, so based on your research in 2023, what do we need to be doing that we're not doing going forward? What are those ingredients that are missing?
Well, specifically with community policing and CNPI, and mm-hmm. we're the evaluation partner on NPI. We've been following it since 2018. We followed and this is important to understand where this is coming from. You know, we followed the officers that were involved and the residents that were involved, and we've interviewed them over 200 times since January of 2019, pre-COVID to today. I think we're still doing interviews. I can look at our team. So one of the things that we see is that the folks involved, including the officers, this is what they want to do. This is why they became police officers, or this is why they want to engage. At the same time, they're becoming more critical of the program, of the city, of the mm-hmm. police department. And so the two things I think, you know, to answer your question, one thing we really need to do, and I've heard everybody say this, is it can't be a program. Look, we need lots of programs. I don't think everybody's gonna be like, yeah, no more programs. But it actually does need to be a philosophy. I do think part of the reason it keeps coming up now, it's actually, you know, almost a battle for the soul of what we want policing to be. And, you know, I appreciated your comment as well. You can't do that without sustained relationship with community organizations and other institutions. The police should not be a poverty reduction institution, right? They should have a specific function. We should know what that is. And then I also think the other element, Laura, to give you one more question, is where, I'll use the word, again, there are other experts in the crowd, accountability. Is it on the front end? Is it on the back end? And what happens in the middle? Right. And so I think what we've seen in Memphis, of course, is very quick turnaround in the releasage of the footage and firing of officers. And that didn't happen, you know, with 5 years ago with Laquan McDonald. That's all good. But that's all back end accountability now. Those officers, some of which were involved in failure to report use of force complaints. Right. And some of our other work has looked at patterns and practices, again, to use those language. What can we do on the front end? What can we do on the recruitment side? What can we do on the accountability side? So I think accountability and I think philosophy would be the two main things I think we're seeing emerge.
And as you said, it has to be integral to everything that you do. And the police department can't be just a little program or even a big program over here.
Absolutely. And, you know, let's just be really honest in this room. It's a weird room to feel like be really honest in. There's like 600 people in here.
No, it's a great room.
But I can tell you, you know, have worked with street outreach organizations in Chicago. For a long time, they wouldn't say they wouldn't work with the police, right? Now, but when they said they wouldn't work with the police, I'd be like, who are you texting? I'm texting Sergeant Tony. Why? Because he's cool. I'm like, oh, okay, that's good. But what is that about? That's about a positive relationship they had with a particular commander or a particular officer. And we're actually seeing that start to change. Now, it's all based on leadership and networks, like who's going to be in those spots and what they have. And that's always a challenge in an institution of policing where you have high turnover in leadership and sort of, you know, different sorts of problems within labor in there. But what it points to, again, is that people that are on the ground doing the work have these relationships. We can learn a lot from those relationships and think about a path forward. And we don't want to police like it's 1992. We shouldn't.
Can I add to that? I think just to piggyback off of what Andy is saying, I think another area that we haven't done a great job of is learning from our mistakes and learning from our failures in the past. And identifying how, you know, what we may have done strategies, you know, years ago have gone wrong and how can we improve on them. But also to take it a step further, it's identify and talk about how those failures may have had an impact between the police and the communities. And some of the trauma or some of the negative impact that has come from our failures in the past, trying to identify, again, how can we try to rebuild or build new trust between police and communities. I think a lot of it starts by learning from our mistakes.
That's key,
go ahead.
And I think that that's one of the immediate responses I have, right, is you can't particularly, a lot of, I will, you know, not to put you on the spot, but, you know,
I feel like there'll be a lot today.
You can take it.
You know, you mentioned earlier, and I completely understand you, CPD is struggling, right, in some communities. And I would imagine that some of the communities that you struggle the most with building those relationships are the ones who have also been the most deeply impacted.
Right.
Right. And so at what point do we actually say, you know, we have to start investing, not just as CPD, but as a city as a whole, in these communities and stop breaking the trust that, you know, one could even say wasn't even built from in the beginning, right? And so we have to start thinking critically as a CPD as a department and how they're showing up, how transparent they are, and making sure, again, not to continue to echo this, but it needs to be an echo chamber that the community should be the standard, right? How are we impacting community? How will this decision, how will this unit that is being put together to respond to the community, how will the community feel about this? Is this what the community wants and needs? And how do we make sure that we're not having consistent unintended consequences or intended consequences, depending on, you know, your perspective, to make sure that we are actually creating communities that are thriving in partnership with everyone and not just the state coming in and imposing on that community.
Is there, are we expecting too much from the state, from the police department? To, I think that the list of things that you just laid out make a lot of sense and very compelling, but are we asking too much for a government agency, the police department, Mike's agency, to do that?
Absolutely not. We're asking for transparency. We're asking for accountability. We're asking for, if you do try something, we're not asking you to stand still and not try anything, but we're asking to make sure that the community is a part of those decisions and being able to say, yes, this will work, because guess what? Community members are experts in their experiences and in their community. And so if they're experts, they should be at the table to say, you know, this could work, or if you try this, make sure you look out or plan for this so that we don't have this unintended consequence, because they see from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. We're asking for communication, transparency, and accountability will naturally come with that. Mm-hmm. That's not asking too much. I think that's the basic thing that we should have.
Can I answer that question and say I agree with everything that Nicole said, that it should not be too much to expect transparency, accountability, partnership, willingness to learn, and you know, the fundamental job of policing should be a problem solver in partnership with the community that's called you in or that you are in to solve that problem. Where I would sort of add an amendment to what she said is, I think as a society, we have sort of abdicated responsibility in a lot of other areas. So the default response is the police are supposed to be the problem solver of problems that they have no business solving. And the community knows that. And they know that. So, mm-hmm. So I do want to sort of acknowledge that we are both failing residents that need a government that is responsive, accountable, effective, all of those things. But we're also failing officers when we are asking them to solve problems when all they have is a hammer and not everything is a nail.
Right.
So we do need to recognize that.
Can I just say one quick thing to that? I think that's also why I said that it has to also be city leadership. This all comes down to leadership. Like, My concerns about where we are as a city, as a country, has obviously it has a lot to do with individual decisions of officers on a day-to-day basis. They have to be held responsible for individual decisions. But we have to hold systems accountable for how we are recruiting, how we're training, how we're identifying not only the officers that are responding to our community, but all the social networks and the social fabric of our communities that has failed year after year, decade after decade, to put us in a position to lean heavily on the police in the first place. Yeah.
So what about, Roseanne, and then I want to get Mike in here because you bring up training and recruiting, and I think that's a really important piece of this.
And just to build on that, things as simple as really understanding how officers are being deployed in communities. I think when you look at the data on the response times to 911, it cannot be good for communities when they're waiting as long. If there's a, you know, level 1A emergency and it's taking officers a long time to get there, it's also not good for the officers when all they're doing is responding to really, really tragic incidents over and over and over again. I don't think they're going to come to the next call in the best headspace. So I think there are some really important basic things that I think are a part of the broader kind of effort around how we hold our police department accountable.
So thank you. So Mike Milstein, are there resources there? We heard about recruiting, training. There's a ton of things in the consent decree that are required. Talk a little bit about what concrete programs that you're engaged in that aid this cause, but do you have enough resources? Is it realistic when we're losing, we lost 1,000 police officers this year, we don't even have enough for basic patrolling? Talk a little bit about that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'll start with recruiting. I mean, yes, I think the vision that we're moving forward right now is that we want to have a more diverse policing force. Doing a lot of outreach to minority communities, trying to get more diverse members join the department. I think in 2022, we hired a little over 900 officers. So we're trying to make up for some of the losses in the ranks. But I think, you know, while it's great to have a more diverse police force, it's not, we shouldn't expect that just having more diverse officers is going to mean more procedurally just interactions.
Happened in Memphis.
Right, we see that in Memphis. And so I think training is another huge piece of here one of the great things with the consent decree is that we're mandated by a federal agreement that we have to do training. We have to do procedurally just training. We have to do constitutional policing. We have to do community policing every single year for all officers across the department. training is never a bad thing. We want to increase training. We want to make sure that we're actually bringing community partners into training. It's one thing
on a regular basis, in terms of the training programs?
We've done it before. We've done it with our community policing program, and we're trying to find ways to do it more often. But basically, the idea is that, you know, when we have training around, say we are going to be having a training on how officers should interact with the transgender community, we should actually have members from the trans community part of those trainings with officers. It's one thing to hear that training from an officer, but it's a whole completely different meaning when it comes from a person of that community. So training is a big piece. And then, of course, you know, going back to the accountability, how do we hold officers accountable to making sure that they are actually executing the work based on the training that they're receiving?
Okay. Rosanna, now you've done a lot of research and looked at other cities and some of the work they've done. Are there lessons what have you learned from, particularly in Los Angeles, I think it's been a success. What have you learned and is it applicable here?
Yeah, I think let's start by saying there's no city in this country that is A-plus on this. I think that there are cities that are better than others and have put more resources into accountability, procedural justice, engaging residents and really kind of articulating what policing should look like in their community. And I think L.A. has done better than a lot of departments. It came under a consent decree. And if Charlie Beck or Bill Bratton or, you know, any of the folks who were there in the early days were here, they would say they did not go willingly. It was initially some kicking and screaming, but it really did take buy-in at the highest levels in the department to model that this is for real. We are going to bring into our police department as head of constitutional policing people who spent their careers understandably suing this police department. We are going to put them in charge of the consent decree because we are serious about the changes. It took way too long, and I don't think we can wait that long. But I think there are lessons from cities like Los Angeles where you can make really, really meaningful improvements in the quality of your policing, the effectiveness, the accountability, and the trust. And what you see as surveys are done in Los Angeles, trust for police has actually gone up significantly over the period of time, and gun violence has gone down. So it's not an either or. You can do both. But I do not want to sit up here and say that LA has nailed it. Mm-hmm. I think in this country, we do not do enough to really have higher standards. We're an outlier in terms of, you know, how we recruit, train, and even what kind of education levels are required in policing in this country. And I think that's a real challenge. I also just want to say
But before you leave that, also, can you give some examples of things that have actually worked? You say that trust has grown.
Yeah, I think bringing in people like Connie Rice, who, you know, is a civil rights attorney who spent her career trying to force the department from the outside to make it better, and then sort of working hand in glove with department leadership to implement. Bringing in people like RF Olakan, who, you know, to be head of constitutional policing.
These
with
are
Gary Chima,
leaders in the department. Okay.
Who are, you know, come at this from a, you know, they're brought into the department to actually be in charge of the thing that they were outside the department pointing to as being the biggest problems. And so I think, you know, I think it really does require doing this not as a box-checking exercise, mm-hmm. but for real. It's not about quantity. It's about quality. And I think even with our consent decree here in Chicago, we have the most number of paragraphs. So each paragraph is something that the department has to do.
Yeah.
We treat the paragraphs as though they're all equal. Certain mm-hmm. things in the consent decree are way more important and urgent than other things. And I would like to see our department putting resources behind the things that are first order important,
even such if it as. Means,
you know, I think there's a whole long list of things, but even just how they're allocating officers to communities, I think, go ahead, I'll let other people speak.
No. how they're allocating that, that's a really big sticking point.
I mean, it's not just about the allocation, right? It is about the allocation, but it's also about the revolving door that community members see. So how do you expect community members to actually build a relationship what happens a lot of times is that you have community members, going back to Andy's point, that have developed a relationship with a commander, with a sergeant, with a lieutenant to actually start building, you know, some level of trust. And then the next thing you know, with no warning, they're shipped off to another district. And community members are like, but wait, what happened? We had such a good relationship. So it's not just about, we have to be able to allocate and put the right bodies in the right places at the right times. But we also have to make sure that we are thinking more critically about not tearing the fabric of communities by making departmental decisions and shifting resources without, again, taking the community into consideration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to say one very concrete example of a department that's done a good job or mm-hmm. improved on what we're doing here, New York City, the way that they select their commander, that sort of level, it's a very robust process yep. that has as one of its decision points is bringing in the community council to interview the candidates to then weigh in on, and then the candidates have to put forth a vision for that community that they're mm-hmm. going to potentially be the commander of. If you're a commander in a community, you're the chief of that small city.
Yep.
And you have enormous responsibility and resources at your disposal and life, liberty, and death-related consequences to your decisions. And in Chicago, first of all, we don't do, and in most cities, I'm not just trying to pick on Chicago, in most cities, getting promoted to that level of leadership within a department is completely accidental. We are not selecting for there are some good people who end up in those positions, but it's quite by accident. We don't develop that cadre of leadership in police organizations. And then, we move them from one command to another, right. and basically they don't know until the day before that they're going to be the commander, and they don't know anything about the community necessarily.
So, and the community doesn't know anything about them.
Andrew, yeah. I know you want to get in, but I want to get Mike in, because Mike, you were nodding your head at some of this in terms of the whole stability question and the moving around question. Is that a big challenge for you? And how? And what do we need to do to fix that?
We hear it all from our communities all the time that, to McCullough and Rosanna's point, that they just made a really great connection with their commander and the commander is gone. Mm-hmm. So I think we're trying to figure out how do we have easier handoffs when that does occur? What are some ways that we can try to address that? We've been hearing that challenge for quite some time now, and I think we're at a point where we're trying to identify how can we start to make some changes there and make a better impact on that.
What about Rosanna's example of the commander selection process? Is that something that you think should be considered here? Is that something that would be workable in Chicago?
I think we can look into it. I know, we have the district councils coming up in the next couple of months. I know we'll talk more about that probably later today. So I think that is an area that we can definitely mm-hmm. look at and, talk through.
Okay. Andrew.
As a Chicagoan, I hate this neck that I'm going to have to say this next phrase, but let's just talk about Los Angeles just for a few more seconds. And to one of the things Los Angeles does is there's a career to being involved in community policing as an officer. And right now, a lot of the officers that residents really like working with or that are involved in these things, they're not respected by their peers. There's not a clear path for promotion. And they conversely are going to stay in this job that they really, really like, or they're going to leave, or they're going to go to a different unit eventually because they want to raise and have kids and sort of all those things. But LA has a whole trajectory and path, which took a lot of work negotiating with the union, but you can make a career doing that type of policing. And right now what happens with an NPI, and particularly what happened in CAPS as well, is this kind of a limited thing for folks. You can do it for so long and then you get moved around. During NPI, they saw this, the beginning of the program, the cops were into it, they were really excited, they were feeling good about their job, then COVID hit, then there were staffing problems, and they got shuffled and they never went back. And then at that point, you're 3 years into a career. And so that is something that is tangible. You can reward and promote the behavior you want to see as a department.
Right.
We tend to reward or promote guns or dope on a table in most instances in CPD and arrests, right? This goes back to why it just can't be a program. If you are saying we want to promote this style of policing, you have to promote those officers into Rosanna's point, into leadership positions too, right? Not just like, oh, great, you're the community policing officer, here's your plaque, now go back to work. It's like you need to think about that when you have your sergeant exams, lieutenant exams, and commander positions. And we don't, inside the police department, that's not how officers treat the cops that are doing that work. They don't see it as real policing, and they'll say it.
And is that about the fact that they're not, as you said, Rosanna, the message is not coming from the top? Do we have, you said we need buy-in from the highest levels. We need buy-in from, that means the mayor, that means the police superintendent, that means the commanders, that means the deputies. Is that what we're talking about? Do we have that buy-in here in Chicago? And if we don't, how do we make it happen?
I think leadership matters. And to go a little bit out of character, I do want to sort of acknowledge how hard the job was for a person coming from outside of Chicago to take over a police department in a city that he didn't know very well yet because he was brand new. And then COVID hit. So I do want to have some empathy for mm-hmm. just how challenging that is. But I do think, we also have a consent decree that is not being invested in enough. We're not putting enough resources behind it. it. So and gun violence spiked. And so I think it is a challenging job. I just will leave it to folks to decide, to speak their minds about whether they're happy with kind of what they're getting in terms of ROI or impact out of their government, and to make that decision. But I do think that we do see when leadership is really bought into something like a Charlie Beck in Los Angeles, into the importance of community violence intervention organizations as a key partner. We've done a couple of events with Charlie Beck where he's basically given the CVI organizations more credit than he does his own officers for the huge decreases that Los Angeles has had. Mm. But they are full partners. They right. play different roles, but they're working in partnership. So I think modeling that kind of leadership at the top about what's important, what you're going to reward within the department, and what you're going to not tolerate matters a lot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Nicole, I wanted to ask you a question, but go ahead and comment, and then I had a follow-up.
Just quickly, I think it just goes back to prioritization, right? Where you put your money and where you put your people and how you promote your people says everything about what your priorities are. And, you know, if we are in a situation within Chicago or pick your city where we are not making sure that promotions and movement and everything like that is rooted again in not just what you're able to accomplish and checking the boxes and guns and so forth, but how did you work with the community? How did you build relationships with the community? And more importantly, what does the community have to say about you? Right. And so I think that, you know, going back to the original or earlier point about the commander and the turnaround, I just wanted to say that I think that we also have to be able to have, it's equally important for community members to be able to say, this commander is not working well with us, and we need to be able to have a voice in making sure that this district or this small city is working in the way that we as community members come together and say it should work.
And that's not happening now in Chicago.
Absolutely not.
Can I make a positive observation, though? Mm-hmm. Which is, I really do think, and all of us have worked in and around policing, and we've seen examples mm-hmm. of great leaders, great officers, that there are people in this city and in this department that want this, that are hungry for this. Yes. So I don't think that this is asking them to do something that lots of people inside the department actually want.
It's a massive bureaucracy. And it's Mike, you know, when we had our prep conversation, you said it's a very, very complex organization, and that's a challenge. As someone brought up the district councils that are coming. So, Nicole, I want to come back to you on that. And could you explain a little bit about what that's about and do you have hope? What hope do you have for that in terms of how that might impact community policing in the future?
So the ordinance to create the community commission, it's complex. So I'm going to try to bring it really, really short. We have a community commission right now that community members across the city fought for. And this commission, going back to the question about front-end accountability, that's what they're there for. They're there to make sure that a lot of the questions and a lot of things that we're grappling with right now becomes a very real part of the conversation and accountability measures for the department to make sure that we are actually getting the right policies in place, that we're getting the right training in place, and that the police department and all of the public safety ecosystem in Chicago is being responsive to the community in a way that they should be. But then also that community voice is rooted in the direction of the public safety ecosystem. Well, then we have district councils that go vote. They have elections on February 28th, and there will be three people elected for every district to actually be a liaison between the community, the district leadership, as well as the commission. Let's be honest, in a city as large as Chicago, seven commissioners cannot possibly have their eyes and ears and a pulse of every single community in our city. But that's where your district council members come into place. These are people that are running to be these liaisons, to be able to hear the voice of the community and be able to, in real time, address concerns that either is at a very local level with the district leadership or is at a higher level within the city with the commission and being able to lift up those concerns so that we are actually having a police department that is more responsive to community needs.
So I don't think that there's a lot of knowledge and visibility of this election. They're going to be elected at the same time as the mayor and the
yes.
alderman on February 28th.
Yes.
What if people want to know more? How do they engage and find out who these candidates are and and make sure that they educate themselves? And do you have recommendations on how folks in this room and anyone else can do that?
Yes. So you can definitely, I believe all the information about the candidates is on the Chicago Board of Elections. So you can find out for each district who's running, what they're about. You know, I'm very impressed and grateful for the amount of work that I'm seeing community members put into running for these positions. They have policy positions. They have long time, you know, been working in the community on these issues, and they care. And so no matter what district you live in, we have people who actually want to be able to have a voice in this, who are running and who are really putting all the effort behind making sure that you know as a community member who they are and that they can earn your vote. And I think that it's important that in the same way that we research a mayor or alderman or anyone else that we go out to vote for, that we research and we understand who is running for these district council positions, because that the life of this will be in who we put into these positions and how they work with the community.
What are the terms?
The term for the district council members are four years.
Okay.
And for the commissioners is 4 years as well, but it will be staggered.
Mm-hmm.
I am not Adam Gross, so I can't remember exactly the staggered process, but I do know that we have a new set of, right now we have interim commissioners, and we'll have a permanent set of commissioners in place by next year.
Okay, well, we have to educate ourselves on this, because it sounds like it's a very important reform we need to pay attention to. I have a couple, many questions from the audience. We're not going to be able to get to them all, but I have a couple that I want to check here, and then I have one or two final questions for the panel. Deborah Bennett, where is Deborah? She's a longtime top leader at the Polk Brothers Foundation. Thank you, Deborah, for your question. This is very fundamental, and it touches on what we've already been discussing, but let's go back to this. Why should Black communities want to develop and improve relationships with an institution that continuously shows itself to be illegitimate due to the way it polices Black people?
I'll go. I think that that's reverse. I think that the police should want to build relationships and earn the trust of community members who have been impacted the most. We all know, and I think it's well stated, that the police cannot, should not, and could never be able to keep our community safe by themselves. We don't even want that. We want to be able to make sure that our communities are thriving, and we want our government, the government, to be able to see us as partners and experts in how we should be policed and what happens in our communities and in the social fabric that is there. And so I think that the onus is really on city government as well as the police department to want those relationships, because it's more valuable to them than not to have them.
Mark, you wanted to?
I'll agree wholeheartedly with Nicole. She's absolutely right. We can never expect anyone to come to us expecting anything. It's on us, on the city, on the police department, to go out to the communities, to meet people where they are, and to try to build that connection, that relationship, and to see how we can work together. I wholeheartedly agree.
Well, how do we make that happen? That sounds like a huge, huge task.
I also just want to say, I think Deborah's question is important, and I don't think that we should start with the premise that you should. I mean, I think that we really ought to be looking at different ways of getting to the end goal of safe, healthy, vibrant communities. And, you know, if there, you know, are ways to do that that don't involve police or involve less and less of police, I think that also should very much be on the table, because I think there is a history here that we have to acknowledge. And, I think I agree with what Nicole said fundamentally, that it's on government to earn the trust of the people being governed. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I think we should be thinking very expansively about what the option set is to get to a place where we have healthy, vibrant communities without the harms that come from, you know, all of the sort of things that we've seen from the wrong kind of government activity. And so I want to acknowledge that.
Okay.
And I would just add, you know, recognizing I'm a white dude who's read a lot in this space, but like, the Black community in Chicago has had a very complex agenda for public safety since the 1880s that has involved reforming, reestablishing the police, and everything else. And what happens, and this is why it's so critical at this moment, is every time crime goes up, the default is the law and order policing rhetoric. And so, and again, the Black community in Chicago has been vocal about what they want in those moments. And they usually only get one thing, and it's usually more policing. So I'm glad that we're having these conversations, and we need to have those conversations. There's a great book by James Forman, Locking Up Our Own, if you haven't read it, that talks about how that played out in the 80s in D.C. And it's one of those things where I think listening, if I, you know, to what I mean here, I mean the institutions, listening to what Nicole said and thinking about, like, what are we gonna then do? Which I think is kind of what we keep coming back to these issues. We want to do something about this relationship. By the way, I'm avoiding the way word positive relationship, if you haven't noticed that. Working relationship. Mm-hmm. For any of you that have relationships, some of them are not always positive. Some are functional. And so I think we need to start there. I was not talking about my marriage. You know, I was talking about other relationships. But I think, like, there's a relationship there. Communities realize this. It gets complicated, and there's not one solution. And so I think at this moment, that's what many of us, I don't want to speak for everybody, but we don't want to just go back to more law and order. We don't want to go back to stop and frisk or stop and frisk under another name. We know, you know, we don't need another study to say mass incarceration is horrific. What we need to do is figure out and listen and think about what we can do and innovate, by the way, which is the other thing we can't do. We need to not be afraid of innovation, trying new things.
And it's hard to innovate when there's a lot of fear. And
when you're scared, it's hard.
The lock-em-up mentality is dominant. Nicole, you're going
to
say something?
Laura, I just wanted to make sure that we bring it to the conversation, even though we don't have time. So I'm sorry to open up Pandora's box. But what we are not talking about is the contract, right? A lot of times the things that are happening within the police department hides behind, oh, well, we have a contract. Mm-hmm. And that contract is not transparent. The process isn't transparent. I know that when we were fighting for the commission, there was another set of community members who were fighting very much so to make sure that we can have more visibility and more say into how the police contracts are negotiated and what's a part of them, so that that could not be another cover. And I think that we have to be able to continue that conversation and make sure that's brought out into the open, so that a lot of things, so that we can't hide behind, and not we, and I also mean that police officers themselves sometimes don't benefit from what's happening in the contract. And so that has to be a real, very real part of this conversation as we talk about reform in Chicago.
Can you give us a couple of examples of things that are in the contract that are challenging?
We can go back to the idea of the revolving door, right? And how officers are put into the district, or how they can, you know, leave the district. That's all a part of contract, right? Even to the point of, you know, how promotions are done, and how we can actually implement into the promotion system or make community policing a real pathway to a sustainable career within the Chicago Police Department. That is all part of contract negotiations, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that if we start really looking at those kind of things amongst a host of other things, these are, you know, places within a contract that should be out in the open, and at minimum, community members should be able to have some insight on.
Rosanna, are there other cities that are more transparent or more engaged with community around contract negotiations?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, Los Angeles, I think, does a better job on that. But I think it's using that as a fig leaf for why we can't change, I think, is you know, a problem. And I think we need to sort of really get under the hood of the contract, understand where the problems are. And I think even things like some of the discipline process, you know, for officers, it's not a very fair, effective, expeditious process. I mean, there's so many things that are, you know, I think there are so many things that are really win-win, better for the community and better for the officers. And we have this sort of, you know, it's the police against the community or the community against the police. And I think on a lot of these things that we're talking about, it's actually good for everybody.
Would you agree, Michael Milstein, with that? And what's your view? I mean, is a contract a challenge for you in terms of your work? Come on, just among us.
There's always limitations around it, yes. So, you know, I think there are always areas that we could look at to improve on how we are able to get officers to engage better in the communities, how we can make the system better for officers who are part of that. I think Rosanna's right. We have a lot of officers who really want to engage with the community, want to do good police work. But sometimes they're challenged, or they're boggled down by different systems that they had to kind of maneuver around. So yes, I think there's always areas for improvement, and Yeah.
Okay. I see a hook maybe coming soon. But I do want to get in this final question for all of you. The elephant in the room is that we have, you mentioned the election, we have at least the first round of a mayoral election on February 28th and then a runoff. What are the three key recommendations that each of you would make to whoever is elected mayor? What recommendations would you make to ensure that the city has a community strategy, community policing strategy that works for everyone? I'll start with you, McCall.
So for the sake of time, I'm going to try to say this in one. I think that right now we have a lot of programs. We have programs everywhere. We have, you know, this program and that program and this public safety, yada, yada, yada. I don't know how much these programs are actually talking to each other or related, or if we're actually taking any kind of stock into how do we make sure that all of these things are working integrally with the community and making sure the community part is a part of that. And I feel like it's a lot of stops and starts. So whoever leads the city, it all comes back to leadership and focus and strategy. And right now, I feel like strategy is not being very strategic. And I think that that's of most importance to actually address this.
Jenna.
Yeah, I just think it comes down to who they choose for superintendent, whether they keep the current one or bring somebody else in. I think they need to articulate what their vision is, how they plan to make it a philosophy, not a program, and what does that look like in terms of resources that are going to be committed to really engaging residents in designing what policing should look like in their community and in their city. And so whoever the superintendent is should really be held feet to the fire to articulate
that. Held, specifically around community policing, they should be committed to doing what? The new superintendent.
Yeah, I mean, they should articulate what their vision is. What does it mean to them?
Yeah.
What is it going to look like in practice? And not in sort of high-level terms, but like specifically, what does that mean in terms of how you're going to allocate resources? Mm-hmm. How are you going to know that you're doing a good job?
Okay. Thank you.
I would say just listen to the community. You know, I think so often, especially in the last couple of years, you know, governments and police departments, they've kind of prescribed what kind of programs that they want to launch, what kind of initiatives they want to launch, because they think that's what the community wants. Sometimes it's completely opposite. They don't want that. It's more harmful than it is good. And so I think just being able to listen intently to what the community is actually asking for, what the community wants, and how we can work with them to provide that for them.
So I'll just add a, you know, a plus one to the, it has to be a central part of the vision of the leadership, which means the budget has to reflect it. The officer allocation has to reflect it. Number two, I think we need to continue, and this is not directly about policing, but I think the mayor's office for public safety and that office needs to be staffed by professionals, needs to be stable, and it needs to have a nice budget, because that is a locus where policing, and to my third point, community institutions can have that stable and beyond individuals, right? So the third thing I would say needs to happen with policing is they really need to develop trust, not just with residents, but with community institutions in the violence prevention infrastructure, whether it's CBI organizations, hospital-based organizations, religious organizations. They actually need to do more than between, you know, Commander A and leader of organization B. It actually, that needs to be part of how we do business in Chicago, is we have to have formal relationships in those spaces. And I do think there are state spaces like this office and some of the coordination stuff that's happening was a natural home for it. And it bolsters public safety without tripling or quadrupling down purely on a police budget that may or may not go to community policing, right? So I think if it comes in these other spaces, other people have a it's on the table. People see it. You have to talk about it. You have to justify it. And also that's where innovation is going to happen. I always worry about stagnation. We have to think about what's happening in front of us.
We don't have time, or we cannot afford stagnation, certainly. This has been an incredible conversation, a lot of wisdom, ideas, and passion and power on the stage. And hopefully City Club will be passing this word on to whoever is going to be on the fifth floor in May. Thank you very much.
My mama didn't raise no fool. I don't follow Laura Washington. Not even going to try. She's awesome. You can give her a round of applause. And now a round of applause for this awesome panel. I was saying to Tim Knight, there's so much academia and so much braininess around this conversation. And while we are admiring the problem, I think there are a group of people in this room who are now ready to implement change. And that literally gave me chills. I was saying to Dwayne Deskins and Shari Runner, who are two good friends of mine and two of the smartest people I know, honestly, I would love to be a fly on the wall to hear them after this post conversation to hear what they're going to talk about. And I think I heard little triplets of that at every table. You know, people were talking about what they could do. So I'm sure Dan has about 85 bullet points in his phone, don't you? Yeah, I already know. And I'm going to hear about all of them probably 10, 11 o'clock at night. I got this idea. And that's how it should be, right? That's why we, that's how we fix or work on Chicago's ills. So having Joe Ferguson sitting at your table is a little intimidating. Just want you to know. I literally was like, would you like some coffee, sir? thank you, Joe, for being here. We appreciate you so much. Megan Hart, I think I saw you. Don't know where you are, but I know I saw you in the room somewhere. Did you leave? Okay. I knew I saw her. Just thank you guys all for being here. It just means so much to, again, have the people in the room to have the conversation. And Nicole and I have just become girlfriends. I don't know if you know that, but we're already good friends. I am not going to delay the time any longer. Prepare for a part two. Get your tickets early. Stephen?
Yes.
Is your last name Robinson?
Absolutely.
Yeah, man, I probably can't have you pull this because you're probably related to me. Okay, I don't know. What's your name?
Chris.
Chris, okay, you're safe. I'm going to have you. I'll explain that joke. It's cultural. If you don't get it, I'll explain to you later. See, y'all got it, didn't you? It's like the third close for preachers. Y'all get it, right? Okay. The gift certificate is a $200 gift certificate to Chicago Cut. I am wearing a heart sweater because today is the first day of February. There are reasons why I celebrate every day in the month of February. Adam and I, we've just started talking about that. But whomever gets this gift certificate is certainly entitled to take whomever they like to a $200 dinner at Chicago Cut. I mean, it's February, right? Did I say it's February, Dan? Okay. Patricia Carrillo, I thought I had them. Each one of you will get your annual membership to City Club. I don't know where they are, though. I thought they were under here, but Amanda will get them taken care of. Not to worry. Again, I cannot thank you all enough. This was awesome. Laura's just bad. I don't have any other words to say. She's just bad. We are going to ask Brandon to come over to take a quick photo, and then I have a feeling there are going to be lines of people up here to talk to them, right? So if I could get Dan to get up out of his seat, because sometimes it takes him a minute. It just does. And we're going to do a quick photo. Thank you. Hey, Shia. Thank you all so much for being patient and going over time. We appreciate it so much. We are adjourned and see you on round two, if not before.